Welcome to the CSIS podcast, a look at the week's news and foreign policy through the eyes of the experts at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm Colin Quinn. This week, President Obama announced the Clean Power Plan, a new set of rules and targets for America's power plants designed to cut carbon emissions by 32% from the current level by 2030. Power plants are responsible for about 30% of all CO2 emitted in the US, and so this plan could go a long way to reducing America's footprint. But with America's burgeoning energy independence on the horizon and the ever-increasing output from renewables, is this plan a game-changer, or is it all a bunch of well-regulated hot air? To discuss this with me is Sarah Ladislaw, Director for Energy and National Security Program at CSIS.
It's a big deal from a few perspectives, right? I mean, I think that the president came into office with a plan to do something concrete about reducing emissions in the United States. The preferred way of doing this was a cap and trade program, and it didn't succeed. And so since that happened, really for the majority of this administration, they have worked very hard to try and do everything they can within executive branch authority to reduce emissions. And the Clean Air Act gives the Environmental Protection Agency the authority to regulate, you know, greenhouse gases and CO2 from power generation facilities. And this does that. And so since 2007, when the Supreme Court basically said that the U.S. should be regulating this sort of thing, it has taken us till now to come up with a concrete plan, and this is that plan.
And to put it in context, how does it stand beside other big environmental regulations like the Clean Air Act or things like that?
Yeah, so it's actually done under the authority of the Clean Air Act, and so it's a further articulation of that authority. I think that there's a lot of people who see it as being landmark from the perspective that it's not like a power plant is just going to put a scrubber on top or put some new, environmental controls on its facilities and manage some sort of local pollutant. It is fundamentally, in the long term, about reengineering the U.S. electric power sector and moving us away towards things that are carbon emitting to things that do not emit carbon. And so that is a much broader economic activity than just, you know, controlling pollution from particular plants.
And talk to us a bit about implementation. There's a level set by the government that the states have to hit, but they can hit it whichever way they like.
Yeah, there's actually an enormous amount of flexibility in the plan. So the EPA basically sets out some guidelines for the level of emissions, either on an intensity basis or on a mass basis. So you think either volume or rate, right? And the states have a lot of leeway in how they determine how they're going to implement that. So it really is state-led at this point, and the EPA will hear about what their plans are and how states think they're best suited to be able to reduce emissions, whether they think that's building new renewables or switching to gas or implementing efficiency. There's lots of different ways that they can do it. Which is very interesting because, you know, we've got 50 states in the U.S. and they all have different electric power sectors and different energy resources. Some are very carbon intensive, some are not very carbon intensive. And so they all have, you know, different options about, you know, how they're going to apply this, and that will feed into the electric power sector in really different ways.
And one of the big questions here is, I guess, how it's going to move. I mean, there's at least probably a dozen states that are majority coal powered. So like a state like West Virginia, something like 80% coal powered, you know, they have to reduce their carbon emissions. Is that moving away from coal? Is it making a smarter type of power plant? I guess it's up to the state, but what does it entail?
So basically it entails them either making the power generation units that they have that are coal or natural gas based more efficient, or switching away from those sources to something else. And so they can either adopt a plan that tries to do that on a facility-by-facility basis, or they can adopt something that is a statewide plan that allows them to say, we're going to use a whole bunch of different mechanisms to do this, including, you know, consumer-side energy efficiency and a whole bunch of other things. And so it's there. In addition, a really big component of the plan is whether or not they want to trade with other states. And so we already have a greenhouse gas trading program covering the electric power sector in the Northeast region of the country. We've got one that exists in California and is actually linked with other states and even some Canadian provinces. And under this plan, those states would be, and other states would be able to credit and trade emissions reduction in their state with other states. And so they actually have even more flexibility than just what they can do within sort of the confines of the state.
So if you're a green state, you can then trade with a less green state and they can still keep doing what they're doing. You keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah. And it's not entirely clear yet because we haven't finished going through all of it, but there is some flexibility to even do that potentially at sort of a sub-state level, right? So that, but this element of, you know, trading between states is intended to drive, you know, economic efficient options for, you know, for states that have a surplus of, you know, low carbon electricity and states that have a deficit of it.
And let's talk about, you know, this is obviously US-based policy, but it's within the context of something bigger. The Paris conference will be on at the end of the year, big summit of all the major nations on the environment. Is this kind of a first bet by the U.S. to see what everyone else is going to do? What do you see it as?
Well, I think it's actually, I think about it a little bit differently, which is this is really the U.S. making good on a pledge that's already out there, right? So the United States has already pledged to the Paris conference that it'll reduce emissions between 26 and 28% below 2005 levels by 2025. And the Clean Power Plan, this, you know, rule that was announced is by far the biggest contributor to how they plan on getting there. And so there was some question about whether or not the U.S. really had to release this rule so that people thought that their pledge was, you know, viable. There are people that argue that even with the Clean Power Plan, the United States doesn't get close to the 26 to 28% that they're trying to reduce. And so therefore, there still is some skepticism about the U.S. contribution going into the Paris talks. I look at it a little bit differently, which is, you know, Paris is not really about cinching up a global climate deal. Like everybody who watches the negotiations know that you're going to come out of these negotiations and you will not be at a world where you have enough emissions to reach a 2-degree target, right? The Paris talks are about trying to get enough ambition and momentum behind good faith efforts to reduce emissions in the big emitting countries. And to the extent that the United States and China have both said, we are putting what we think are fairly aggressive pledges on the table. They are only out till 2030 and 2025, respectively. We intend to do more as we are able. When you look at how hard and how politically contentious what the Obama administration is doing right now, and it is definitely politically contentious, that's a good faith effort, right? I mean, you're basically saying we're going to do everything within our power, and they have everything within the executive branch authorities to tackle this issue. That's about as good a signal as a country could give in sort of going into one of these global talks. And so I think that's whether or not the Clean Power Plan stands and all of those other, you know, more controversial issues is certainly of interest to other countries. But I think the point is that the Obama administration gets to go in and say, we have tried everything we can to show that we're serious about tackling this problem, not only in the Clean Power Plan, but in the vehicle efficiency standards they've put in place and the appliance efficiency standards they've put in place and just the way they sort of talk and deal and think about climate change.
Well, how optimistic are you? I mean, you look at Kyoto, you look at the Copenhagen conference that was nothing good came out of that, really. Is it easier now to make these, or is it becoming easier to make these pledges as efficiency improves, as renewables get more efficient as well?
It seems like one of the things that's changed since those, you know, previous two conferences you've talked about is that there's actually a lot more activity in other countries around the world, both to promote low carbon energy technologies, but also in their ability to sort of penetrate into markets, right? So the progress that's been made just in a few years on these issues is really one of the things that's driving momentum, right? If you didn't have sort of the financial collapse in 2008 and 2009 and all of the stimulus spending that went into this in, you know, places like China, the competitive advantage that places like China and India see in, you know, in sort of developing low carbon technologies and implementing them and what's happening in Europe, I think it would be much harder to, you know, to come out into these negotiations feeling like there was something worth creating momentum around, right? But I do think that there has been progress made. I still think that folks that think decarbonization is hard are right. It is very difficult to change a system that's 80%, you know, fossil fuel dependent to something that is, you know, decarbonized. But if this is, you know, if these talks are about, you know, creating momentum around those things, I think that there has definitely been more activity outside the United States that really does sort of encourage the United States and other countries to try and put their best foot forward.
I suppose when you look at now that it seems that the U.S. is gas rich and has a lot of its own resources, that maybe the climate change issue becomes less of a point.
That's interesting. I think that is definitely one perspective. I mean, I think one of the strange things about the last several years has been that the U.S. has gone through a hydrocarbon renaissance, producing more, you know, oil and gas than we have in a very long period of time. And yet we're able to decarbonize a little bit, right? So our emissions are down and we've made a lot of progress in terms of decarbonization. And so there is a lot of people think there are a lot of people thinking about, you know, can you have your cake and eat it too? And how do you do that? Like, how do you produce oil and gas and reap the benefits that your economy and your security situation get from that, but also push forward on climate change? And I think it's in the recent oil price downturn, one of the fundamental questions was, you know, as oil prices are lowered, you know, just sort of the oil and gas sort of mantra in the United States go away, and do we, you know, not care about climate change and all of these sorts of things, and are renewables disadvantaged because, you know, oil prices aren't high and so renewables are much more expensive? And I think for the first time in a long time, that's not really true, right? I mean, we still see the value in producing oil and gas to the domestic economy because we've reaped so much of it in the last several years. And so there's a lot of goodwill around producing hydrocarbons in that way. But in addition, renewables have made a lot of progress and are still bolstered by public preference. And then also the cost advantages that the cost reductions that you've seen from a lot of renewables and new financing mechanisms and a whole bunch of things that are still sort of driving renewables. And so in a way, I do think that they're both not like equal footing, but, you know, sort of still advantaged relative to one another.
You know, now that this has been announced, it's going to have a lot of people who aren't going to be happy with it and a lot of pushback. How optimistic are you that this is going to be able to be implemented in the current form that it is?
Yeah, and I think it's a great question. And I think that first, there are a lot of lawyers and a lot of people who are going to, you know, debate whether or not the law is strong enough as it is. And I really think that only putting the law through its paces in the judicial system, maybe all the way up to the Supreme Court, is going to answer that question, right? The real important question is, what do states do in the meantime, right? And so in some way, I think that ultimately is sort of the big question, is how states decide they're going to plan or not plan to participate in the law, and what are the sort of ramifications of that. I think ultimately, you know, the best strategic vantage point for the United States is to try and figure out a pathway forward, right? And so if states choose to do what's in their best economic interest, given the sort of parameters of the law, then maybe we'll have an economically optimal outcome. If we go sort of the political route and, you know, spend a lot of time fighting over whether it's legal or not and rescind it and try and find another route and all of those things, you know, and I'm not sort of judging, you know, the legality of it in saying that, is you really, you know, there's a harm that's done to the investment framework here in the U.S., right? I mean, clear signals allow people to know how to invest. And I'm not sure we're in an area where there's going to be clear signals universally throughout the U.S., depending on how states deal with this and how long it takes the courts to get through it. And so I think that that's something that we should probably, you know, spend some time thinking about. And ultimately, we'll have to sort of be the reality of what's happening in the U.S. for the next several years.
And that was Sarah Ladislaw rounding out our show. The CSS podcast will be taking a 2-week summer break, but please do go back through our archive of 44 podcasts and counting for more analysis on world events. And of course, you can always find more on csis.org. If you have any topics you'd like to see covered on the podcast when we return, you can email me at cquinn@csis.org or find me on Twitter. I'm Colin Quinn. Thanks for listening.